I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Years from now, when historians try to make sense of the path to war in Iraq, chances are they're going to get stuck on one man who remains an enigma even today. His name is Ahmed Chalabi. His family was once as close as you could get to royalty in Iraq. Since that time, he's appeared on the world stage as a math scholar, a banker, an accused embezzler, a pal to the King of Jordan, and a spy. But in Washington, he's known for being the most vocal and most effective advocate for toppling Saddam at a time when the U.S. administration was looking for just such a voice. He was once favored by some in the Pentagon to be the future ruler of Iraq. No more. Since a recent raid by U.S. authorities on his Baghdad home, Chalabi is finding that yesterday's powerful friends are today's powerful enemies.
United States intelligence officials have accused the once-favored Iraqi politician, Ahmed Chalabi, of warning Iran that the Americans were able to read its intelligence communications. Media reports quote the U.S. officials as saying Mr. Chalabi told an Iranian official in Baghdad that Washington had broken Iran's secret intelligence code.
Condoleezza Rice, the U.S. National Security Advisor, is now promising a full investigation into accusations that Chalabi, or one of his people, leaked secrets to the Iranians. This hour we'll be talking about Ahmed Chalabi's long and curious relationship with U.S. leaders, and we'd like to hear from you. What does American support for Ahmed Chalabi reveal about the road to war, and what does his fall from grace say about the current state of the U.S. occupation in Iraq? How will history remember Ahmed Chalabi? As a liar or a crook or as an Iraqi patriot who helped rid his country of a vicious tyrant? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is the writer Jane Mayer. Her article about Ahmed Chalabi is in the current issue of The New Yorker, where she works as a staff writer. You can find a link to it on our website. We're at theconnection.org. And Jane Mayer is joining us from the NPR studios in Washington. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. You met this man we've all been talking about. I'm fascinated to know what he's like face to face.
Well, I'm sorry to say that was the magic of writing. It wasn't face to face. It was voice to voice on the telephone from Baghdad. But I spent about an hour talking with him. And he is charming. He is quick, funny, just very smart, completely fluent in English, of course, having been educated both at MIT and at the University of Chicago. And I could see after speaking to him how it was that he so seduced Washington, really. And as one ambassador said to me, former U.S. ambassador to Jordan had said to me about Chalabi, that he just ran circles around the Washington bureaucrats, and you could see how he could do it.
Which is why you ended up titling the article The Manipulator?
Well, I don't pick the titles, but that's why my editors did. He was.
Is it a fair choice of words, do you think?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
I think that he's just a fantastically manipulative operator who had a very obvious goal in mind. He was not being sneaky about it. He was pretty upfront. He wanted to get the U.S. into a military confrontation in Iraq in order to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And he did everything he could think of to make this happen over a campaign that he waged for about 13 or 14 years, beginning around 1990. And he just gamed the U.S. I mean, his own daughter, Tamara, who is also a Western-educated woman who I think went to Harvard, said to me, you know, the reason Washington is mad at us now is that we beat you at your own game in your own backyard. And that's how they look at it.
Now, you say he gamed the politicians. He did a pretty good job in the last little while of gaming the media as well, didn't he?
Well, that was a huge part of his plan. I mean, from the start, I mean, if you go back, if you look at the whole tortured history of this, which is completely fascinating, I found, it's starting in his relationship with the CIA, which was around 1991. The U.S. Intelligence Agency started funding Chalabi and an opposition group that they were trying to create together, the Iraqi National Congress. And pretty much the whole plan for this group was to manipulate the media from the start. They had an operation in London, and it was working out of a PR firm called the Rendon Group, which had contracted with the CIA. And they were spending millions and millions of dollars every year. Sometimes, according to one of the people I interviewed in this, who was part of this project, $40 million a year they were going through. Creating news stories about the atrocities of Saddam Hussein, who, of course, you know, there was plenty of fodder there,
and
placing these stories in the Western press. Now, there are laws, of course, that prohibit the spending of U.S. tax dollars on propaganda particularly propaganda that's aimed at the U.S.
Doesn't mean it can't be published in the London papers, though,
right? And so what they did was, that's why they set up in London, and they would place these stories, all kinds of stories that were aimed at bringing down Saddam Hussein, and then watch as the stories bounced, as they put it, from London all over the world, and particularly back to the U.S.
And
every now and then they would get in trouble if there were too many stories that they were placing that were so too obviously getting into the U.S. news media. But they became experts at working with the media. And, of course, as we've all followed, the run-up to the war in Iraq was very much a media campaign.
Well, they shifted into overdrive after 9/11, didn't they?
Well, they certainly did, and they supplied, again, many of the stories. In fact, they've fairly cut and dried about what they describe. They describe stories, news stories, as product. In an internal memo that the INC gave to Congress, they talk about the product that they have placed in the U.S. media, and they boasted about having influenced 108 stories. I guess it was in about a one-year period. And it right in the run-up to the war. And many of these stories are the ones that we are now all looking back over and wondering whether they were information or misinformation or else possibly calculated disinformation.
Can I stop you on that one, Jane? Because
yeah.
As I read your article, I had this sinking feeling in my stomach when you were talking about the fellow who was marked as Saddam's bomb maker, Khadir Hamza. We actually did a program featuring him, and I was stunned to see the date of the program, October 25th, 2001, 6 weeks after 9/11. And I thought that, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, mea culpa, let's just listen to a little sort of telescoped package of what we were putting on the air 6 weeks after 9/11. Is Iraq the next target? The U.S. has long considered it to be a state that sponsors terrorism. In fact, prior to September 11th, Iraq was most wanted on the State Department's list of terrorist-friendly states. Connection listeners, we're looking this hour at evidence of Iraqi connections to the recent terrorist acts. What should the United States do if it's proven that Iraq played a role? And how would any action affect Iraq's neighbors and U.S. friends in the region? Telephone number is 1-800. Let's bring Dr. Khadir Hamza into the conversation. He's former director of Iraq's nuclear weapons program, author of the recent book Saddam's Bomb Maker, the terrifying inside story of the Iraqi nuclear and biological weapons agenda. Dr. Hamza,
it has to be some kind of regime change that will make it safer for the region and the U.S. And another thing is, there is a limited window to do this, for what Ms. Frank is saying. According to German intelligence, Saddam is rebuilding his nuclear weapon programs. Of course, we were working or rebuilding it till I left in 1994, but all defectors since then and intelligence information since then point to a very fast-paced rebuilding of the nuclear weapon program. And German intelligence estimate that by 2005, Iraq will have three nuclear weapons from the existing uranium stockpiles in Iraq. So by then, it would be much more dangerous to go after Saddam or his regime. So actually, there is a limited window in trying to do a regime change in Iraq.
That from a connection broadcast 6 weeks after 9/11, late October 2001. Jane Mayer has been researching the work of Ahmed Chalabi, who was certainly instrumental in making sure that the man you just heard, whose voice you just heard, was put out before the American media. And Jane, my shirt's off. You can start with a birch rod.
Well, you weren't alone. Much of the media carried information about what was supposed to have been a nuclear threat from Iraq at that point. And I actually think in looking back, absolutely nothing had more impact than the stories about their possibly having the ability to build a nuclear bomb that Saddam could use against the United States. What could be more terrifying? I mean, it was the absolutely complete, argument closer, I think, for many people, including myself. I remember at that time being on the fence about whether we should go to war against Iraq. But when I was convinced that there was a nuclear threat, I too thought, well, we have to do this.
And you heard Hamza in that interview talking about German intelligence, which was one of the what's now seen to be or thought to be a plant that was part of the INC's whole program to convince the rest of the world that this nuclear program was being built.
Well, let's look carefully at Hamza, because I think he is a perfect illustration here of the problem. And it basically, so far, both Chalabi and the other officials at the INC, the Iraqi National Congress, have said that they did not deliberately misinform anyone, and that they were not responsible for any misinformation that came from the defectors that they provided to the press. But I took a close look in this article at Hamza, and what I found from interviewing a nuclear scientist named David Albright, who runs a center that studies the nuclear threat here in Washington, who had been working with Kedar Hamza. And what he said was that when Hamza first came to him, in the late 1990s, his information was reliable, but in fact Hamza helped deflate inaccurate stories about the threat from Iraq, but that when Chalabi was trying to pass legislation to get the U.S. to go to war against Iraq with the Iraq Liberation Act in 1998. Somebody from the INC, either Chalabi himself or somebody else, called up Hamza and berated him and intimidated him because he was, as this person who got a hold of Hamza said, getting in the way of the cause, and that he had embarrassed the INC, embarrassed Chalabi, and they really shook him up. And at that point, after he had been intimidated by the INC, according to David Albright, he became unreliable and started also inflating the peril to a point that it was ridiculous. And, of course, it turns out that there was no nuclear program. We now know this, and everybody who has gone in, all of the Iraqi survey group and David Kaye, everybody who's gone through Iraq has found zero evidence of a nuclear program. And but this is the closest you can get to connecting the dots between Chalabi's organization and deliberate disinformation.
And another person that you quote in the piece, Robert Baer, a former CIA officer, says at one point a line which sort of, I think, marks it in the overall review you have, and that is that Chalabi was scamming the United States at a time when the United States almost wanted to be scammed.
Yes, I think, I mean, as a writer looking at Chalabi, one of the questions I had was who was manipulating whom? And in the end, I think he was, if you had to pick a word, the enabler. He provided the arguments and the evidence that was useful and necessary for those in the administration who wanted to go to war against Iraq but needed to convince the American public that Iraq posed a threat. And he, through his defectors and other evidence, made it seem that the threat was there, and he also made it seem that the war would be easy. And
I
that
need
we
to
would be...
stop you there. We're going to come right back after our break. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm talking with Jane Mayer about her research into this fascinating character. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Use that to contact us this hour as I talk with Jane Mayer. She's staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, covers politics for The New Yorker from the Washington Bureau. Her latest piece is about Ahmed Chalabi, certainly a creature of Washington over the last 10 plus years, and currently at the center of many discussions involving whether or not there will be investigations involving people at the Pentagon, the FBI, the State Department, the Central Intelligence Agency over information provided to the United States about going to war in Iraq, and information that may have been provided to Iran about the way that secret information is intercepted. Jane, I want to just go back to the conversation that you had with Chalabi, because you spoke to him by phone at his house in Baghdad 3 days before that house was raided by the U.S., right?
That's right.
Did you know something was up? Were you doing a sort of, hey, how are you doing profile, or did you know that the sand underneath his feet was starting to shift?
Oh, I think both he and I knew. I mean, it didn't take a genius. He was becoming the center of all kinds of allegations. Nothing quite as dramatic as we're seeing right now, but you could certainly feel that the conventional wisdom was turning against him in Washington. And that's what he and I were talking about. Actually, in the beginning, he said to me that he said, I am in bad odor. And he said that he felt that he was being set up as a scapegoat for everything that had gone wrong in Iraq. And he considers himself quite a scholar of American history. And he said, sort of ironically, it is traditional for the U.S. to punish its friends and reward its enemies. And he was looking at what he thought was going to be some trouble coming his way. And of course, 3 days later, the Iraqi police burst through his door backed by U.S. troops.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're taking our first call from Burlington, and Jerry's joining us. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, what I think is that this is nothing new. That I mean, I'm not all that old, but I remember in Vietnam that they, you know, the term kakistocracy, the government by the worst. And I think that's what happens, but it's not the United States that's particularly looking for the worst possible representative. It's just they're looking for somebody in, who fights in their interests. And then if they step out of line, I mean, there's a lot of questions about how much the United States puts all these people in power, Bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, all of these guys. And so long as they do the United States' bidding, they're fine. And they step out of line, and they steal a few quarts from Kuwait or whatever it might be. Then the United States gets very indignant and pure.
Well, based on what you've been able to read, Jerry, do you think that Chalabi was delivering the goods that he originally promised, or that he started to go a little bit offside here?
Probably the latter, but I really don't know enough about it. I haven't read the article yet. I do get the New Yorker, but I haven't read that article yet. Mm-hmm. But it's not the one person that I'm particularly interested in. It's the whole a hypocritical viewpoint the United States government has in putting these terrible guys in power and then acting like, I don't want to be sexist, you know, like the prostitute who's suddenly protesting virginity, you know. It just gets tiresome.
Is it, I wonder, Jane, in your view, this something of a repetition, as Jerry says, of what the U.S. has been through before with its Noriegas and its Somozas and other people who are at one time friends and at another time enemies?
Well, I think you can certainly see a pattern there. I think it's a fair question about why the U.S. ever turned a blind eye in the first place to who Chalabi really was. It's one thing to say that he's charming and seductive, which he is, but our professionals who run foreign policy in Washington are supposed to be very wise to the ways of the world, and I think they succumbed to him and stopped looking closely at a long history he had of, among other things, a spectacular case of bank fraud and embezzlement that took place in Jordan, where he was convicted in absentia by a military court, and he just fled to London. And the CIA picked him up right after that with hundreds of millions of dollars having been alleged to have been stolen.
But you're very careful about that, Jane. You're not saying that he stole the money. You're saying that some people said he stole it, and the military tribunal found him guilty of God knows how many different potential crimes. But it seems so much of what that man's history is is based on rumor and suggestion.
Well, I mean, there's a tremendous track record. With anybody else, they would have been sunk long ago, I think. And one of the things about Chalabi that's fascinating is that he just never says uncle. No matter what the charge is, he has always got a ready explanation for why it is that he is actually innocent and being framed, which is, again, of course, what we're hearing right now. But, I mean, in the bank fraud case, I mean, he was found guilty, I think it was 31 counts of embezzlement, theft, forgery, currency speculation, making bad loans to himself and his friends. The bank had overstated its assets by over $300 million, and something like $158 million had just plain disappeared. And he has said that all of that was made up, and it was made up by Jordan because Jordan was in the thrall of Saddam Hussein, its neighbor. And
handling his banking affairs for him, and somewhat beholden to him. Yeah,
and that Saddam Hussein had framed him, and yet there was an Arthur Andersen audit that was done of this, and it found exactly all of these things to have been exactly as he was charged, and it also found that related institutions that had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein in both Lebanon and Switzerland that other members of his family were running also had similar sort of financial problems. And at any rate, he just argued so strenuously. He still has – he's currently got a lawyer, two lawyers that he's employed to countersue Jordan. They haven't gone ahead with the suit, but they are full of documents to point out what was wrong with the conviction in the first place and how unfair it was and how it was just a political – frame up. And, you know, basically you cannot nail him on anything without his having an explanation and something that you at least need to consider.
Did you ever find out, Jane, how much money Ahmed Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress actually took from the U.S. coffers? I mean, you mentioned at one point over $100 million, perhaps $40 million from the Bush administration alone. There are people that are saying they ended up with a lot more than that.
Well, it's impossible to know. Maybe Congress can find out, but the reason it is that much of the U.S. aid came in form of covert dollars. So an easy estimate is over $100 million because there was a period starting in around 1991, where, as I quote somebody named Francis Brooke, who was working on the program, said that they were spending, as I mentioned earlier, $40 million a year, and that lasted for 3.5 years. And then you get this $39 million during the Bush administration.
It's a lot of money. I want to go back to our callers. We're going to Buford, South Carolina. Elaine's joining us. Elaine, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I really enjoy the show. I have a comment and a question.
Yeah.
How come if a lot of the Washington insiders have stated publicly that, and after knowing the history of Chalabi, that the only thing they admire about him is his tailor, how come these, what I consider to be bumbling, incompetent fools in this administration, didn't know better, and are they going to be held criminally responsible for appropriating taxpayer money to this double or triple agent and launching, using that information to launch a fraudulent war?
Will the accusations, if any of them stick to Chalabi, end up ricocheting off to the people within this or earlier administrations, Jane, who played ball with him?
Oh, it's a hard question. I don't really know the answer. I do think part of the reason that he was in, as he put it, bad odor even before the raid was there was the beginning to be the sense that Congress wanted to hold hearings and ask questions about him. He was becoming political baggage, and so he was jettisoned as quickly as they could get rid of him. They cut off his funding.
Right.
And distance themselves quickly. You know, this current investigation by the FBI's counterterrorism task force, which is looking at whether or not somebody in the U.S. government might have given intelligence secrets to Chalabi, is something that could result, I suppose, in true criminal charges against somebody in the administration. It's really unclear right now what's going on in that investigation, though. And I have to say that I think that so much of the reporting in the run-up to the war and the reporting that involved Chalabi has turned out to be wrong, that as a reporter, I'm loath to say that that I really truly know what's going on in the inside of this investigation, because it is, I don't think any reporter really does know. And we're getting very strong, contrary points of view from the Department of Defense, which says nobody's being investigated,
right,
and from the FBI, which says there is an investigation going on.
Next to Nashville, Tennessee, Bill's joining us from there. Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. What I'm hearing touched on, and I don't know that I know if the focus has been exactly resolved here in this conversation, but I'm hearing a kind of a tension between whether Chalabi was somebody who played the U.S. or he was a creation of the U.S. or certain forces within the U.S. hierarchy. And
I think that's a great way of putting the question, Jane. Was he in some way invented by people who needed a character like that?
Well, this is the way I look at it, is that he was the little boy who cried wolf and the U.S. gave him $100 million megaphone. It was a joint partnership.
But let's also put on the table just how cleverly this man played the partisan nature of Washington politics, because by getting the principle, the idea of regime change passed by a Clinton administration, he was then able to turn that to his closer contacts, the neoconservatives that he made friends with through the 90s at the think tanks, who wound up in the Pentagon and in the White House. I mean, was that just good luck, or was that brilliant foresight?
Chalabi and his assistant, Francis Brooke, opened up an office in Washington and also bought a townhouse in Georgetown in Washington. And from that location, they studied how Washington works. And his assistant, Francis Brooke, had actually been in Democratic politics before joining Chalabi. And the two of them studied how the African National Congress managed to get legislation that it wanted. They looked at Jewish organizations to sort of see how constituent politics played out. And they created an American-style political campaign to get legislation that they wanted that would commit the U.S. to regime change in Iraq. And the reason that they particularly created that piece of legislation, which was the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998, was that Chalabi had studied very consciously as a model of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's the means by which he moved America into World War II. And he looked at the Lend-Lease program that Roosevelt had used to commit the U.S. as a partisan in that war. And they very much modeled the Iraq Liberation Act on that. And they also studied the makeup of the Hill. And they figured, it was in Republican hands and the White House was in Democratic hands. And they used their own experience of CIA failures in Iraq as a weapon that they could give to the Republicans to beat up on the Democratic White House. I mean, they talk about it all in this article. It was just what Francis Brooke describes as naked politics.
Now,
and
Jane, you study that city. You understand how it works. When you went through this and saw the way that they were able to work the system, were you sort of left thinking, hey, well, that's just how things happen here in Washington? Or was there a part of you going, wow, these guys just had everybody cold?
I thought that the latter. I thought it was just amazing. That's why I'm amazed they told me the whole story about how they did it. It's an inside story of how they gamed Washington. They drew up a list actually of the 150 or so most influential people on the subject of Iraq in Washington, and they set out to meet them and woo them. And before long, they were on first-name basis, Chalabi was, that is, with 30 or so members of Congress, senators and congressmen. And he also worked very closely with a number of key aides on Capitol Hill who really took up for him. And, you know, I mean, the thing is, in one way, you can look at this as a person who had tremendous, ideological convictions that Saddam Hussein had to go, and
right.
There are a lot of reasons why you can see that was certainly a goal worth achieving. But at the same time, they seem to me to be willing to use any means to get to that end, and that's where the questions are raised. Did they lie, cheat, and steal to get there?
My guest is Jane Mayer. She has written a feature looking at the life and times of Ahmed Chalabi. It's in the current edition of The New Yorker magazine. You can find a link to that at our website. We're at theconnection.org. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Next call from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Ralph's with us. Ralph, thanks for calling.
Hi, Dick. Great show as usual. Yesterday, Bush at a news conference said that he barely knew Chalabi. Is that true? I find that hard to believe.
Jane?
Well, he said that he might have met him twice, he thought, once in a rope line.
Wait a second. He sat the man behind his wife at the State of the Union address. That wasn't just an accident.
Well, in fact, I think he has, according to Chalabi, the two of them have met maybe four times personally. And so I don't really know what kind of personal relationship there is between President Bush and Chalabi, but it's not really the right question. The Chalabi's influence was with the vice president. Dick Cheney and Chalabi go back to a friendship that was forged in the mid-1990s when Cheney was out of office and working at AEI, a think tank here, and also becoming the chief executive at Halliburton. And there was a direct open pipeline between Chalabi's organization and the vice president's office. And so when Chalabi dug up information about weapons of mass destruction, it went directly to John Hanna in the vice president's office. And there's a memo trail from the INC that shows this. Now, I think I have read that Hanna has denied this, yet, as I said, there's a memo from the INC that says that he was their direct contact. The other place that they had tremendous influence, of course, was in the Department of Defense, where Chalabi forged a kind of an ideological partnership with Paul Wolfowitz, and I think Wolfowitz was very taken with Chalabi's view of how Iraq could be turned into a kind of a demonstration project for democracy in the Middle East, and a country that was at least tolerant of Israel, and so the two of them were very closely connected, and again, the INC's information went unfiltered and directly to the Office of Special Plans underneath Wolfowitz in the Defense Department, where, again, this kind of inflammatory raw intelligence was pipelined straight into the bureaucracy of the U.S.
Just very briefly here, because we're going to another break, Jane, but the lead line on the story in the Wall Street Journal this morning is the civil war within the Bush administration over Chalabi. And I'm wondering if that's the way it looks to you as well. Between all these agencies,
there is a huge split. Obviously, the CIA thinks he's a crook, and the DOD, some of the people there still think he's George Washington. Literally, they've told me.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Is Ahmed Chalabi the man who is going to lead Iraq to a form of democracy, or is he someone who has manipulated and burned too many bridges in his own attempt to try and get rid of Saddam Hussein and place himself in a position of power? What does Chalabi's time in Washington tell us about the way this administration and other administrations use people like that or get used by people like that? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour we're talking about Ahmed Chalabi, a character whose name is much in the news now as someone who is being accused of passing secrets to the Iranians, perhaps turning on his own friends within the Bush administration. Before we went to the break, we were talking about what the Wall Street Journal describes as a civil war within the Bush administration, pitting the FBI and the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon officials all against each other as they try to make sense of the direction or switch in direction from Ahmed Chalabi. My guest on the program is Jane Mayer. She's staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and wrote a feature article about Chalabi called The Manipulator. And I should tell our listeners, this has just moved over the news wires, word from Washington that the director of the CIA, George Tenet, has resigned. And Bush has spoken very briefly about that at the White House, saying that Mr. Tenet has been a strong leader in the war on terror and that his deputy will temporarily lead the CIA until a successor is found. Tenet, of course, has been under tremendous pressure in terms of looking at information that was leading towards the 9/11 investigation. More of that will come out this summer. Jane, I know this is as new to you as it is to me, but I suppose some of the CIA involvement in understanding the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, how good their information was, whether or not that information was coming from the Iraqi National Congress and whether or not too much was trusted, that's going to be a part of the fallout as people examine why it was George Tenet chose to resign today.
It's fascinating. A lot more reporting's got to be done. But really, the question about Tenet for quite some time has been how he can stay in as long as he has. I mean, he is the man who, if you read Bob Woodward's last book, described the case of weapons mass destruction in Iraq as a slam dunk to the president, telling him it was an absolutely certain thing. And of course, we have seen that it was anything but once inspectors have gone in and looked for this after the war. So there have been multiple intelligence failures in Iraq. And, the interesting thing about Tenet, though, vis-a-vis Chalabi, is that it was the CIA that was onto Chalabi, or at least felt that he was unreliable and kept trying to warn the administration off of him. And it's the CIA that has been, in many ways, putting out the information that he's just not to be trusted.
So paradoxically, count this as something in Tenet's credit when we talk about the impact or the effect of Chalabi on turning politics in Washington.
Well, it's a complicated question, though, too, because if the CIA had questions about this information, they obviously did not stop the president from getting information that had come through Chalabi's system. And in fact, an awful lot of the defectors, false information that came from defectors, false or faulty, whichever you choose to believe, worked its way into speeches by Bush, by Cheney, by Colin Powell, that famous speech in front of the UN. Mm-hmm. And so you could say that if the CIA had questions about Chalabi, they did not protect the president from nonetheless using this false information.
All right. Just a programming note for our listeners. You will get more information from NPR News at the top of the clock and throughout the day on this breaking story from Washington, the resignation of CIA Director George Tenet. And that will also be the subject of our first hour tomorrow on The Connection. But we have with us Jane Mayer, who, as I said, has done a feature on Ahmed Chalabi. This is a part of the complicated puzzle. And rather than continuing on with Tenet, while the information is still so sketchy, we should take advantage of Jane's presence and continue on that topic. A reminder, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And to Providence, Rhode Island, Bill's on the line. Bill, thanks for calling.
Hi, nice to talk to you. I think that it's really quite premature to count Ahmed Chalabi out of the picture. First of all, he has not been arrested.
Yep.
His nephew, Salem, is still going to be prosecuting Saddam Hussein and has all those wonderful documents that link every possible Iraqi leader to their past relationships with Saddam Hussein.
His other nephew is going to be prime minister.
That's correct. And so that's not his nephew, actually. It's actually
a cousin
of his nephew.
No, wait a minute.
But seriously, in Middle Eastern families, the distinction is not very important, really. I mean, families are quite corporate. And even though there's some bad blood or there's some rivalry between Ahmed Chalabi and Iyad Alawi, they still are members of the same family. They have to talk to each other. They have to go to the same weddings. And so that's a very interesting thing about it, but also his connections with the U.S. administration are all still extremely strong. For one thing, his Salem Chalabi is in a law firm with Douglas Feist, who's Assistant Secretary of Defense for Policy. Also, the official lobbying organization for the INC, the Iraqi National Committee, is a law firm in Washington.
Bill, let me just stop you there. I mean, I certainly take the point and the research that you have done on this, and I think that it's a really important moment in the program to sort of stop and take cognizance of this, Jane, that
well,
despite
actually,
the fact they're chucking file folders at each other at congressional hearings, Chalabi's not down and out, is he?
Well, just to correct the record, I think the caller's got definitely a good point worth considering, but I've got to say that the law firm issue is no longer an issue. For a while, Chalabi's nephew, Salem, was a partner with a former partner of Doug Feith's, and his name was Mark Zell. But that partnership fell apart very quickly, and in very unusual ways, actually. What happened was that Mark Zell was publicized in Iraq as being a strong Zionist, and as soon as that happened, he became political baggage, and the two of them split up right away. So that's not an ongoing venture. I'd say that the reason, if anything, the reason to think that Chalabi's got a future still ahead of him in Iraq is not because he is closely tied into the U.S., but actually because he's breaking up with it. He has described that some of these turns of events is nothing but a gift in Iraq, where he wants to not appear to be a puppet of the U.S. In some ways, it's very useful for him to have the U.S. dumping on him. And he's a man who has reinvented himself over and over again. And he seems to right now be cozying up to the Shiite factions in Iraq, and in fact, a detractor of his in Jordan said to me that Chalabi would become an imam if he had to, in order to reinvent himself. He's just a protean force. He's so bright and so relentless that I don't count him out exactly. But he's also not a popular person in Iraq right now. His standing is below that of Saddam Hussein, which is saying something.
Though, I mean, the story still remains the embodiment of the building blocks for someone who wants to construct a conspiracy theory here from either side, Jane. And I'm wondering, in your own research, did you ever sort of stop and say, I wonder if Chalabi engineered the raid on his house? I wonder if Chalabi had intended all along to have the U.S. sort of turn on him at a point when it's not fashionable to be
now
friends with
thinking,
anyone in Washington.
You're thinking like somebody from the Middle East, since everything is not what it appears to be. No, I don't think that he engineered the raid. I think it was a very rude and humiliating affront. But the man is right. He's not been convicted of anything. He's not been actually accused of any crime either. He is also at the same time, according to multiple sources, amassing huge influence in Iraq through all kinds of business connections. He is said to control much of the financial sector through his allies who are in all the key positions. So, and he, of course, is a man of great wealth. So I don't write him out.
I want to just sort of let some of our listeners in on how he is presenting himself recently. Ahmed Chalabi was interviewed by Tim Russert on NBC's Meet the Press a week ago Sunday, and you can hear in this clip how he mixes his sort of anti-U.S. sentiment with praise for the United States at the same time.
Iraq is not Latin America. It's not Honduras. And I would say I have a piece of advice for Ambassador Negroponte. If he thinks he will comes here and provides diplomatic cover for the control of Iraq through covert operations, I think he would be sadly mistaken. Iraq seeks to be a democratic country, and the majority of the people of Iraq will express their views in an election. The process that is going on now in Iraq to select a government, the Brahimi, Bremer, Blackwell process, will lead to a failure of the government after June 30th. I call on President Bush, who is still the most popular politician in Iraq, to convene a meeting of Iraqi leaders in Camp David to iron out this process and put in place a government for Iraq that is effective, representative, and can lead Iraq to elections next January.
Now, I don't know, Jane, what television or newspapers you're reading, but it's been a long time since I heard anyone describe President Bush as the most popular politician in Iraq.
Well, that was a tricky little dance that you listened to, but if you decode it, What, excuse me, Chalabi is really saying is Brahimi did not want him in the government. He didn't want him in the transitional government. And what Chalabi is saying is he wants to sidestep Brahimi, go directly to President Bush, and be included in the process of deciding Iraq's future. He wants a seat at the table. When Brahimi didn't give him one, he started working in opposition to the UN and to this whole plan, the temporary plan for the government in Iraq. Over the years, Chalabi has always said that he had no self-interest in this issue of running Iraq, that he was doing it as a patriot only, and never wanted to run for office himself. But I asked him recently about this. I pressed him on it, and I said, never? And he said, well, never is a very long time. So I think what he's really thinking of doing is working in opposition to the temporary government, if it's not one that includes him, and with an eye towards possibly running in the election next year, or else running a candidate who will represent him in that election.
It will undoubtedly, Jane, be the most delicate bit of tightrope walking he has ever done, if he's able to pull this one off, because, as you say, he needs to make sure that he is somehow disengaged from his sugar daddies in Washington. He needs to recast himself as an Iraqi patriot. You were saying earlier he needs to buff up his Shiite clerical credentials, at least to be seen as a man who's respectful of Islam. Can he do all that? Has this man got the wherewithal to do that? Not in Washington, but in Iraq?
Well, I spoke to an old friend of his who watched him closely in Iraq maneuvering among the Shiite recently, who came away shaking his head and said that the mood in the room was one of rapture when Chalabi spoke, even among the Shiite leaders. And so he seems to be getting some traction there. It's one of those things. I hate to resort to cliches, but time will tell. It remains to be seen. I just never count him out, I have to say. Many people I interviewed, though, suggested that the biggest issue will be whether he can stay alive. He has so many enemies in so many different quarters, and it's obviously such a lawless place.
Does he still have the free Iraqi forces providing the bodyguard work that they did when he first went back to Iraq after the invasion?
Well, he has basically a private militia of some 700 people.
700?
Yes, but what happened when the raid took place on May 20th was they disarmed a number of his bodyguards, and the people around him said that they felt it was almost like a death wish for Chalabi. But then I asked them, well, is he then unguarded? And they pointed out that no, he's actually got backup guards with backup guns.
He'll be fine, and we'll be writing about him again, won't we?
I think for a long time.
Jane, thanks so much for being with us on the program today.
Glad to be here.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article about Ahmed Chalabi is in the current issue of that magazine. You can find a link to it at our website. We're at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Doug Sugarts, and Mike Toda. Special thanks today to John Hoder, Glenn Alexander, Dara Manoogi, and Brian Myers, and Carl Volker for their help with the program. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.